This is the Everything is a Primary Source podcast, the show where history is learned through the analysis of popular culture. I'm your host, Eric Paul. This episode reaches across the 20th century, connecting 1912 to 1997 through Titanic, the ship itself and its Edwardian era disaster, as well as the 1997 blockbuster film that was such a huge success. I spoke with Gina Oppenheim, the Senior Education Fellow for the Hamilton Education Program at the Gilder Lehrman Institute, which is the leading organization in history education through primary sources. We spoke to decide how each iteration of Titanic act as reflections of their respective eras and inform us more about them. Take a listen.
Been a great week for me. Has it been great for you, Gina, from Gilder Lehrman?
Yes, it's been awesome. I've met so many fascinating people like yourself.
I am fascinating. Everybody says so. I'm also very modest. So you've had, what have you been doing at the conference mainly? Just bringing more attention to Gilder Lehrman,
yes.
What you offer.
So what I particularly do, I work for the Hamilton Education Program, so I'm sort of the lead educator on there. And what I do is teach teachers how to utilize primary source documents to do creative pieces with their students from the founding era in the same way that Lin-Manuel Miranda did to create Hamilton.
Yes. I was just talking to somebody about Lafayette, yes. And how he's portrayed in Hamilton. And I bring up Hamilton all the time with my students of this is, and even John Adams, because John Adams had his time in the spotlight probably 20 years ago in the HBO series,
yes.
Based on the book. And the way that one was filmed, it was very immersive. It was like very 21st century of like, this isn't going to be third person. You're going to be, you know, shaky camera. You're in, you know, it's dirty looking.
And I got to interview Laura Linney about playing Abby
Adams.
Yes.
That must have been incredible.
That was amazing.
She seems great.
She was amazing. It was during the pandemic and we were doing sort of all these read-alongs and different sort of in-person, or, you know, online sort of in lieu of in-person programming.
It was so funny. During that same time period that she and Paul Giamatti were in HBO's John Adams, they also did The Nanny Diaries.
Yes.
And
a little different.
Yeah, quite a bit different couple relationship there.
Yes.
They're not writing letters to each other.
No.
In fact, they're avoiding each other throughout
about
that
story. About saltpeter, yeah. No.
But it's just so funny seeing them, you know, interact like that. And then their son at the costume party on 4th of July dresses as George Washington. I just thought that was a funny little, like, John Adams is now in charge of Washington.
I love it when pop culture gets full circle.
Yeah,
like
it actually can be maddening. You're like, it's all these tangled up knots and everything like that. But that must have been really nice talking to you, Laura.
Yeah, and then I've also been here talking about our MA program, which I just graduated from.
All right. And so and that's actually where we connected earlier,
because
we were talking
about the NA program, which is an online program, and we have all these amazing teachers, David Blight, the whole plethora of just Denver Brunsman, all these just sort of leading historical figures.
Well, I always turn my students towards Gilder Lehrman, because not only do you have great secondary sources, but your primary sources are so well curated.
Yes.
And but they don't just stand alone. They have great context that goes along with them. And I'm glad to hear that you're doing, encouraging people to do more with them. You know, an activity like, and off the air, I'll tell you more of things I've done with primary sources that I've learned at conferences and stuff, and put my own twist on it. But that's exactly what Hamilton was. And
absolutely.
Is him saying, inspired by this story, I'm going to make something out of it. And the choices made for casting and the kind of music and stuff, it's very much a reflection of the times that we're in, because Hamilton, the character, takes on the role of an outsider,
looking
almost
in.
Like an immigrant. 100%.
And what I love about our curriculum, though, too, is that, I mean, one of the critiques of the show is that sort of certain voices, there's a diversity of actors, but not perhaps voices in the show.
Mm-hmm.
And our curriculum directly sort of acknowledges that we have a whole Black Lives in the Founding Era portion. So we have so many people who just, you can only in a 3-hour show, you know, display so much. And Lynn does an amazing job of just highlighting certain key figures in Hamilton's life. But there's so many other figures in the period. Phyllis Wheatley, you know, Sally Hemings gets name dropped, and what did I miss briefly? But she's just a fascinating figure. Benjamin Banneker, there's so many sort of diverse voices that we don't really get to hear in the show.
I've been working with a museum in Portsmouth, New Hampshire called the Moffett Ladd House. And there's, of course, and that was the home of William Whipple, who was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. And for, of course, the entire length of time since that, the history has always known about his enslaved person, Prince, that lived in the house, Prince Whipple.
Yeah.
Who fought in the war as a soldier.
We have info on him on our site.
Right. And what it seems to be, and it's also very much a sign of where we are now, that the stories of people that had been in the margins of history for so long are now in the spotlight.
Absolutely.
And it's very much, and it's not like you don't have to like really dissect it. It's like, here's why, because they've been forgotten about for so long, yet everybody, their contributions are important and their relationships are important. And the way that he related to William Whipple in the time period and is also very telling of the time period.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
His signature on the Declaration, you know, his the enslaved people of that area put together a proclamation of freedom, basically, that they submitted to the state legislature that was only recently posthumously approved of. But all of that is coming to light now and is being incorporated into museums' stories, their narration, even though the buildings themselves haven't changed all that much in 100 years since they've turned into museums, the stories that they tell are.
Yes.
And it's not just to keep them fresh. It's because it's like we've not done it for so long.
Yes.
So we were talking yesterday about Titanic.
Yes, and that actually is directly related to our MA program.
Perfect.
Because, yes. So I always love to look at things through a pop culture lens, which I know is your jam as well. And sort of what gave me the idea, so our MA program, your last semester, you have to write a capstone. So it's a detailed 50-page research paper on an original topic that you think up. And I had talked, my kids were, Titanic had come on Netflix or some streaming platform, and they were talking about the movie, Leonardo DiCaprio, all this stuff. And they were just really talking about it like all these people were real people. And obviously some of them were. You have Astor Guggenheim, but then, you know, the fictional characters.
Yeah.
But one of my students was like, yeah, but it says everyone on that boat was white, right? And that sort of gave me the idea. I was like, huh, that's sort of the way it's been portrayed. But let me look at this. And I started going through the ship manifest and looking at the different immigrant groups that were aboard. And you sort of, the Irish had been well represented in popular culture. But there was over 100 Syrian passengers in steerage class, which you don't realize. There was a large number sort of Jewish passengers. So many so they had a kosher chef in third class. And people didn't realize there was a dedicated kosher kitchen. And then too, in second class, there was a Haitian family, Joseph LaRoche, who was a Haitian aristocrat, married a white woman in France, and they had two biracial children. And he's never talked about, and he was a huge hero, helped load boats. You know, his pregnant wife and two children survived. You never heard about him. In fact, there were so many great poems and stuff written in the black press about the Titanic, and part of it was like, hey, this is sort of, you know, white fallibility, right? Fragility, literally in action, because there's no people of color on the boat, literally erasing somebody in the black press at that time. And then in first class, too, you had a Mexican dignitary and you had a Japanese dignitary in first class, and you never hear their stories.
And so if we're talking about the movie, it's curious that, you know, mid-1990s, you would think that the conversation would come up that maybe we shouldn't make the story what it was, of just, you know, that we could have made it a lot more, almost like a, you know, like Love Actually, you know.
Absolutely,
where it's like all
yeah.
these different stories kind of happening
at
once.
Yeah, and to be honest, I think that people had just been relying on such books as A Night to Remember and other things, those as primary sources, which really excluded people of color from the narrative. And James Cameron even talked about that in sort of in recent interviews, that he wishes sort of he had utilized more diverse sources because he just sort of is going on what had existed. And that's why what sort of really inspired me as well, there's a documentary, and if anybody gets a chance to watch it, it's not available fully streaming in the United States, but it pops up. It's called The Six, and it's about these six Chinese survivors of the Titanic, because if you actually look at the ship manifest, the group with the largest survival rate were these Chinese sailors, because there was 8 of them and 6 fully survived. And if you think about that percentage-wise of any immigrant group, it was huge. And in this documentary, a big thing they talk about is that they survived partially because they didn't speak English. So when they heard the warnings, people were being told in third class to stay down, they just were like, we're sailors, we know what ice smells like. And they got into the ships. And that, you know, I discovered that through this documentary, but then also if you look at the U.S. Inquiry trials, which is teachers, it's so great to use. I love having students play act, because you can get it's like a play script, the transcripts of the United States Senator Smith, this guy from Wisconsin was doing these Senate hearings. At the same time, they were making all these new immigration laws. So one of the things they were trying to talk about is like, sort of there's all these desirable immigrants who died on the ship. There's all these Finnish and Swedish immigrants. And again, even in talking about that, you're cutting out all the people of color on board. But it was in this inquiry trial that you heard about these Chinese passengers, because he talks about how these Chinese sailors were, you know, some of the people who survived, because all the people who testified were only first class passengers and crew members. Yeah. And I think there was one Irish third class, but they didn't have anyone. There was like maybe one woman who testified, and that was Lucille Duff Gordon, who's like basically invented the fashion show.
Oh, really?
Yes, which is a whole like conversation. She invented the runway fashion show, and her husband, Sir Cosmo Duff Gordon.
I think the tragedy of the Titanic, and it is a tragic thing, the loss of life when it shouldn't have happened. The Edwardian mindset of nature, who cares about that anymore?
Well, right,
you know,
also,
we can do whatever we want.
And that they talk a lot about the Anglo-Saxon superiority, and that it was constructed by a full Anglo-Saxon design team. That's in the White Star Line materials. They say that.
It's like, don't worry, this thing's going to, you know, we don't even need lifeboats. We'll give you a few for decoration, but we're not even going to need these things.
They had more than were required. That's what people don't realize.
Oh, really?
So they had more than you were only required to have for like a certain number of, you didn't even need to have for every passenger.
And it's a tragedy, because every one of those lives could have done something.
Could have done something, and especially when
even if they didn't achieve things like curing, you know, the disease of the era, just living their life all the way through and inspiring and affecting the loved ones close to that. I mean, it's so tragic, and to be deduced to just like a list of names that people...
list of millionaire names. And that's the other thing that's so important to talk about with students, is that it was an immigrant ship.
Yeah.
That's what people don't realize.
As a mail ship too, as RMS, Royal Mail Ship.
Mail ship, and it was carrying artifacts, it was carrying, you know, museum pieces, there was carrying rare book manuscripts and all this stuff.
Everything is a Primary Source is building a digital archive, and you can get involved. Perhaps you would like to add to this conversation, or start a new one about history through pop culture. Go to everything-history.com to learn about the Everything is a Primary Source project, and how you can take part in this exciting, new, open-source educational resource. And now, back to the conversation.
I think one of the reasons why the
97
movie was so successful is because you have James Cameron, action
CGI,
you know, action director, doing a romance picture, and it's a period piece. So it's like three kinds of genres all into one, and that's why it was so huge. But knowing that you have this opportunity, this actual vehicle to, you know, because like we were talking yesterday, there's lots of versions of Titanic in movie form. They're all basically the same story.
You have
in the 1990s this opportunity with like the special effects. Like, we got that covered. We're going to be good. Why don't we take this chance to give the story of the people who don't get the attention?
Yeah, and
the
you know, he actually, in the deleted scenes, there's a couple deleted scenes that I mentioned. They have one of the Chinese sailors.
Okay.
Floating on a door, which you can kind of guess then where James Cameron used that idea later on.
I'm curious if, and you said he's spoken to this again, and I know that a lot of directors, they are their own worst critics. They go back and forth, and that's why maybe it's ill, the idea isn't the best one, but they'll sometimes do a director's cut or they'll re-release a movie and it's like, just leave it.
Well, he just had the 20th anniversary. That would have been the opportunity to do it.
But I think that let's say it wasn't made in 1997, made in 2017, I can guarantee you it would have not been Rose and Jack.
No,
story.
I mean, what he said is it was Romeo and Juliet at sea.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, that's the best way of putting it. And
except where one lives. If Juliet lived.
Yeah.
And Juliet did see.
And we don't want to take away from the movie as its place, but you're right. It's like a missed opportunity.
Completely. And you say this about, it's something I love to remind my students too, is actually, when the first Titanic movie came out was in 1912, 10 days after the disaster. Dorothy Gibson was a silent film star who was on board.
Yep.
And she kept her nightgown that she wore in the lifeboat, and they filmed a silent, one reel in New York City it's called Saved from the Titanic. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, like a lot of silent films, it was lost. But you can still see some promotional footage from that.
And it's incredible because that was, motion picture was so new in that era that they still hadn't really decided what its proper use was for.
No.
And it seems like that was like the crossing between entertainment and information.
Right? And you think about reality TV, right?
Yeah.
Like that's literally afterwards.
I mean, how would you imagine if you survived something that traumatic to be like, hey, you want to relive it real quick?
And she talked about how much PTSD that gave her too, then having literally to wear the clothes she was rescued in to then film it. They made her wear and show where the water stains still were.
So it's like the movie industry was, it just maintained itself. Mm-hmm. It's not that old of an industry.
No, and that's what
people
don't realize.
It's like 100 years old.
Yeah.
And so it's like they, absolutely in 1912, they're still learning about themselves and how to properly use it. It's just such a wonderful, we could talk all day, and I do want to talk to you further about this, but I just want to, bring this as far as other stories from history or, I always see it as, the movies that are selected or the stories that are selected to be put on film, there's a reason. That time period is
and
when
why
they
that
do it.
Yeah.
Why do you think that James Cameron chose? I know that he had a interest in Titanic already, but is why then? Why did he do it at that
so
time?
So a big thing that I think about with the Titanic is you really think so. It was around 1,300 people who died, which is horrific tragedy. But you think there are so many others. There's the U.S. Slocum, this ferry boat in Brooklyn that, where 2,000 people died. There were so many other tragedies at that time just because there weren't the same kind of regulations at sea. But why was it Titanic that has captured people's imaginations? And I think James Cameron crystallized it when he kind of talked about, you had the leading figures from that day. At that time, if there were the Kardashians, John Jacob Astor and Madeline Astor were sort of the most famous people in the world. So you have this lens and this idea that it was this end of the Gilded Age, this American industrialism, and the idea then of watching sort of this idea that everything we touch turns to gold, and then really seeing Mark Twain's The Hole, but it's tarnished gold, and that's sort of a literal embodiment of that sort of Gilded Age
and
hubris.
The name of the ship could not make it any more ironic.
Anymore, and I think that people have always been fascinated. Yeah. And then there were so many urban legends. I mentioned about, that there was artifacts. The huge story at the time was that there was a mummy on board that was cursed who then did it. And that was in some of the popular press. So I think all these things, people are always, we think about rising up from your bootstraps. Americans are very aspirational in sort of our ideology.
Yeah.
So this is something aspiring to be on the ship. Even if you're in third class, it's aspiring.
Yeah.
If I work hard, then I can be, when I take my trip home, I can be in first class.
Yeah.
And that didn't really exist in Europe because it was so much more of a class-based system. And I think that then is why it's captured people still, because we still have that ideology. Why do people, a lot of times, sometimes people vote against their self-interest. It's because they want to have that sort of aspirational ideology.
I like that you use the word crystallize, and because Titanic was so popular, I guess maybe another, I don't know if it's unfortunate, but nobody's going to make another Titanic movie for a really long time.
You say that, though. Actually, there's the musical that's being released in films.
All right.
In movie theaters, and they're talking about
I'll
maybe
cut
doing
that part out. But I want to say that's probably, even if it has nothing to do with the actual story that the movie Titanic has, it's still going to be tethered to it in some way because of
that's
how
so
big
successful.
It was. It's almost like, and so I wonder if, because I think about that a lot with other recycled stories. You know, in the last 20 years, we've had like 5 different Batman stories.
And well, think it's about like, the Civil War. How many Civil War stories have we had?
Yeah, and but even that, I think that there's a weird, there's like gaps in Civil War stories. You know what I mean? Like, I think about, like the movie that did it for me was Laurie. Because I was like... Because
you hadn't heard that story.
I was at 8. I was only 7 years old when that movie
came out. Yeah, and I saw it when I was a kid, too. And that story brought the USCT. We hadn't... Yeah.
And talk about... All right, so this is a great
way
to...
And then the monument,
That brings it all home, because we started by talking about Hamilton being inspired by primary sources.
Yeah.
And even secondary sources. He, you know, I know Lin-Manuel Miranda read the biography of
Alexander
Hamilton.
Yeah, the turnout.
And that's what he, you know, prompted him. But then... The story of Glory was from the who would be the director of Glory, or at least the screenwriter, being in Boston, and across from
Boston Common Hill,
across from the State House, is the 54th Massachusetts Regiment statue, you know, the embossment memorial. And he sees this thing and he's like...
It's like, that's a story I have to tell.
Right.
But even with that movie, as much as I love it, I showed it for students recently and they're like, if that was made now, you wouldn't have it so focused on Shaw.
Right. And it's a primary source movie because it's all his diaries and stuff, but you're absolutely right about that. It would elevate the other... And it also... there's this great book that... I don't know if you've ever looked at it or read it. It's called... it might be like Past Imperfect or it's about... Hollywood.
Oh, Causes Fought and Won, the Gary Gallagher book?
It's more of like a, it's almost like a database book. It's not really a narrative. And it's, they go through movies that depict history.
Oh, that sounds good.
And they have historians write the actual history. And then they rate how close the book or the movie is to it.
Find that.
And, I checked it out so much from my school library that the librarian just gave it to me after a while.
Amazing.
And,
you're like,
I lost it. But in that, it points out with Glory, it says, you know, the majority of the 54th was actually free
right,
men.
Right, but they it was Frederick Douglass's sons.
Right, and it was
the
like...
Unit.
And
were so educated freemen, yeah.
The character that...
Denzel Washington.
No, the other gentleman, the Andre, Adrian Brower.
Yeah.
The character he plays... was actually the far more common
right.
Of
I mean,
that.
Frederick Douglass appears, but you don't hear about his sons.
And that part is always kind of cheesy. Yeah. Because, like, Frederick Douglass, and he turns around and almost looks like some guy went to the Halloween store
totally.
And bought the Frederick Douglass outfit.
And they don't mention his sons even at all,
yeah,
which would have been a perfect moment.
And the guy's, like, doing his best Frederick Douglass
totally.
Impression.
Well, and they also have him up on the balcony
yeah,
in that
it's
scene
very,
at the parade.
He's like...
No, and my favorite moment in that whole movie is when they're marching through South Carolina and they see the young enslaved children and they're like, we're coming.
One kid in that movie has a wristwatch on. That's
no,
one of
really?
That's one of those like things that you know, flaws that you can point out. And if you freeze frame
glad
it,
I didn't
like
notice
somebody
that.
Like waving and it's like a digital watch.
Well,
at least it said 1863.
Yeah.
But it was, that movie did it for me because
yeah,
I was
absolutely.
Like, I was already interested in Civil War, but I would just nonstop draw battle scenes in the backs of menus, or not menus, but placemats at restaurants.
Oh, I lived in New York City and desperately wanted to have relatives who fought. My father had to tell me, we came after 1900, so
isn't
no one
that,
fought.
Well, and that goes back to the Confederates in the Attic, the Tony Horowitz.
Oh, I love that, Tony Horowitz.
Book, that's another one of those books that, like...
Completely love that.
And he mentions that his own family history begins after the Civil War in America... And it might be that fact, that almost like fear of missing out or that feeling of, and I feel the same way. Like my wife has been doing a lot of family research lately, genealogy, and she has actual evidence of a relative that fought in the Civil War, actually two.
In the Union or in the?
Actually both. They were brothers. One, he got paid to go fight for the Confederacy, and they're from Pennsylvania. But the other one.
Wow, that's
and
a story. There.
It is a story, right? Actual
Pennsylvania,
brother
you don't think.
And the other one fought for. A regiment
you don't think someone in the north,
Pennsylvania?
Yeah.
Well,
you
actually,
that in the South.
She submitted a piece to Atlas Obscura about this in Spencerport, New York, where her parents live. In the cemetery near their house, behind their house, actually, there is a. Confederate soldier buried there because he lived in New York. In fact, his name was DeWitt Clinton,
Really?
And then whatever last name it was, because he was named after the governor of New York during the Erie Canal
amazing.
Governor.
That's amazing.
And he, before, as the war was about to break out, I guess he was working for some southern businessman who basically paid him. And it just, those kinds of stories just tell you, it proves to you that a pretty sizable portion of the fighting troops in that war were not doing it on any kind of philosophy.
And that's something we talk about. You know, a lot is that it was, yeah.
Like in New Hampshire, there's this up, you'd have pockets of abolitionists that, you know, but they're up in the northern hill country. Those guys did it for the bounty because they were so in debt. And not even deeply in debt for our standards, like $5 in debt. They were super poor, and they knew that they'd get a $500 bounty just for signing up for the army. They were like, I got to do it. You know, I have no choice but to help my family in some way. And so they weren't going off to war for the cause of emancipation.
Emancipation didn't even come in the picture until 1863.
Right, and then you had lots of people deserting because they were like, I didn't sign up for this. This right. isn't what my cause
was. And then you had all these USCT troops coming in.
And then they filled the ranks.
Being amazing,
and,
yeah.
I mean, we could go on and on.
Yes, I know.
I think it's so great. But let's wrap things up, and I just want to say a few words afterwards. But thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is a great way to end the
conference,
and I hope you enjoyed it. So,
thank you.
Go to Gilder Lehrman, right?
Yes.
And I always tell my students that anyway. So.
Yes, and I also host the Book Breaks program,
yes.
so on Sundays at 2 o'clock.
How do we find that?
Yeah, so if you just go to gilderlehrman.org/bookbreaks, and you can find our whole list. We have awesome. H.W. Brands, we have David Blight, we have past recordings with so many amazing historians.
That's so wonderful. Thank you so much
thank
for stopping
you for
by.
Having me.
I can't say enough great things about Gilder Lehrman. As a teacher of a wide range of American history topics, I've used GilderLehrman.org as a necessary companion site for research and enrichment. The creativity-focused Hamilton Education Program, for which Gina is the Senior Education Fellow, makes Gilder Lehrman that much more vital to teaching about the past through primary sources. Find out more at GilderLehrman.org. The Everything is a Primary Source project is a collaborative, open-source digital archive of oral history based on reactions and relationships to popular culture. Each entry into the archive begins with a conversation recorded during one of our Your History Through Pop Culture exhibits, also known as podcast karaoke. These are held at a variety of different venues and can be booked for your school, library, museum, or business to be carried out in person or virtually. The next step is to post the primary source in its appropriate category at everything-history.com and supplement it with a short essay contextualizing the book, movie, album, show, toy, game, gadget, or whatever else might be the subject. This will usually be done by us, but these essays could be your way of collaborating. Each recording typically covers just one or two of the 9 critical thinking questions that are asked in order to decide what an artifact tells us about time and place. This leaves room for teachers and their students from all over to contribute by recording their own thoughts on the subject until all of the questions are answered. You can even take part without typing or talking. Each entry will have a space for you to include your pictures of related primary sources that help make the time period and place in question clear. Teachers and their classes are able to use the archives as reliable secondary sources while the entries are under construction, and absolutely when they're completed. While some topics might be reserved for older students, the Everything is a Primary Source project will always have something for everyone. The Everything is a Primary Source project promotes history, media, and digital literacies, cultural appreciation, and collaboration between people of different ages, geography, and backgrounds. Ultimately, it demonstrates how fun it is to learn about history through pop culture. Start your collaborative journey today at everything-history.com.